Support for KNKX comes from WSECU, offering 3 new Visa credit cards and 3 new checking accounts. WSECU's goal is to help make the right card make a difference. More information is available at WSECU.org. WSECU, serving Washington since 1957.
You want to set the scene for us a little bit? What era are we talking about here, and how long was your hair?
Talking about early 70s, and I cut my hair for the trip.
Oh, is that right?
That's right.
In order to not attract extra undue attention from the cops?
Exactly.
Well, I'm Gabriel Spitzer. You're listening to Sound Effect here on 88.5. And I'm talking to our colleague Nick Morrison about one of the, I don't know, the darker parts of your resume. What would the job title be?
Part-time smuggler.
So how did you get involved in this caper?
Two friends of mine had a pot-growing operation in the Sierra Madre Mountains, kind of above Mazatlan. And I was hired to go on a driving/smuggling trip into the Sierra Madres and back out across the border into Arizona with a car full of pot.
And we should say that you were approaching this kind of from more of a maybe a gonzo novelist point of view than a career criminal point of view. Is that fair?
Yeah. I mean, I didn't have a job holding me down. So when they made this offer to go a smuggling with them, how could I say no? I mean, they'd been doing it successfully.
It'd be very easy, really.
Well, they'd been doing it successfully for a long time.
So what happened? What did transpire?
As we were going down deep into Mexico, we started seeing more and more evidence of what was going on up in the mountains. Like, we were passed by a flatbed truck that had pieces of helicopter, burnt out helicopter on it. Somebody had like shot a helicopter down or something. And I'm asking Mike, you know, I wonder what that's all about. And he said, oh, it's nothing. Once a year, they go through the mountains and they sweep the pot fields. But they probably won't be down there yet, probably. We went up a series of ever smaller roads, of course, to a mango orchard. And while Ignacio and I were digging up the pot that was buried in the mango orchard, the pot was getting packed away and all was seemed to be going fairly well.
Did you think, I could do this? I could pull this off?
Oh, my, yes.
I can rock smuggler.
Oh, yeah. You know, I wanted an eye patch and a sash and everything.
So what happened next?
Well, as we were packing the pot into the compartment, we heard horses coming down through the hills. And we knew it was Campania. We knew that there was a military campaign going on. And we heard horses thundering through the jungle. It was riders coming out of the jungle down toward us. And before I could think, Ignacio and Mike had turned off their lanterns, and magically, guns appeared in the hands of both of these men, and we were flat on the ground. And that's when I thought, I'm not cut out for this.
There's a lot more to this story, and you can hear it if you check your podcast feed in a few days. But meanwhile, that hubris of being so sure that you've planned the perfect crime, only to find out that you have wildly miscalculated, that's what our show's about today. It's stories of the imperfect crime on Sound Effect from KNKX. Let's go back now to a time when very few of us are at our best. Age 14. It's a stage when many of us don't consider the consequences very carefully before we act. This story comes to us from Derek Erdman. He's been on the show before. He's an artist, a writer, and a lifelong prankster. But when he was 14 years old, living in Strongsville, Ohio, he committed an imperfect crime that would recalibrate his moral compass.
Well, I had a friend, Paul Tempest, and we were both, I guess, you know, somewhat clever, but also not. We didn't have a lot of parental supervision. He had a single father. I had a single mother. We had a lot of time alone. So we spent a lot of time skateboarding. We were kind of like the punk rock kids of Strongsville, Ohio, which is a very behind-the-times suburb of Cleveland. And we wouldn't do overt crimes such as shoplifting or anything terrible, like damaging personal property. I did get arrested beforehand for stealing credit card carbons, and it eventually turned into credit card fraud, but we would just, I would say, innocently up to no good. Paul often called me on the telephone when you had to dial them. Paul had misdialed my number by one digit. As soon as he heard the answering machine message, very excitedly called me and said, "Wow, you really have to call this guy's answering machine. It's, you know, Survivor's Eye of the Tiger with his very dorky voice over it." It was truly like, "Hey, this is Dennis. I'm out looking for the Eye of the Tiger. Leave a message and I'll give you a call back when I'm done looking for the Eye of the Tiger." We sort of made this guy out to be like a real loser. You know, like kind of like a lonely guy with the meek voice who likes Survivor. And as nefarious as we were, I realized that I eventually could change his outgoing message. And us being terrible teenagers, we made the outgoing message possibly the worst outgoing messages that you could. We left so many messages. "Hey, this is Dennis. I've kidnapped a busload of kids and I'm going to drive them off of a cliff. But when I'm done, I'll give you a call back. Thanks." Or like, "Hey, this is Dennis. I'm naked in the bathtub and I'm drawing myself on with a Sharpie. And when I'm done, I'll give you a call back. Hey, this is Dennis. I'm rearranging my house and I'm going to put my couch on my refrigerator and then I'm going to be naked and run outside in the backyard. But I'll call you back." It was truly awful. Like, truly awful. Having sex with himself in the bathtub. There were like a few like that. We only thought that we had control of this guy's answer machine. That was exciting. But like the repercussions of like a business contact calling him, you know, like that did not cross our minds at all. It was just that we had done this thing and other people could call it and hear what we had done and that it was funny. We were cruel. You know, there were a lot of other kids who were cruel at school, and us being like the alternative punker kids in Strongsville, Ohio, you know, we had funny hair, we had funny clothing, so we were definitely the targets for abuse at school and bullying. We probably turned that bullying to somebody else, onto poor Dennis. So one morning before school, as usual, I went to Paul's house and decided to call Dennis to change his outgoing message one more time. And it was no longer Survivor's Eye of the Tiger. It was just Dennis's voice who said a very simple, "Hey, this is Dennis. I'm not home right now, but I'll give you a call back when I'm back home. And if you're those kids who've been changing my outgoing message, I got you. And you'll be hearing from the police shortly." That whole day was absolutely terrifying. That was when, you know, like the jig is up, you're in big trouble. I definitely realized that these things were very bad. Later that day, while I was in school, two police from the Middleburg Heights Police Department, which was one town over, came in and pulled me out of class. So after being in the police station for an hour or so with the police, Dennis finally showed up. And he turned out to be a school teacher for the Cleveland Public School System, which is a huge school system. And he was just a very normal, fit, brown hair, no receding hairline. He had glasses. He was dressed cleanly. I had to sit with my mother and Dennis and three policemen and listen to a long compilation of the recordings of the answer machine messages that we left.
"Hey, this is Dennis. I've kidnapped a busload of kids and I'm going to drive them off of a cliff. But when I'm done, I'll give you a call back. Thanks. I'm naked in the bathtub and I'm drawing myself with a Sharpie. Hey, this is Dennis. I'm rearranging my house. I'm going to put my couch on my refrigerator and then I'm going to be
I couldn't help but laugh during one of them because the whole situation was so absurd and I was also absolutely terrified. And eventually I was told by a policeman that it was not a joke and put in a jail cell by myself. After that, I had to sit with a detective and Dennis and explain how I was able to change his answering machine message. I think he was, in a way, happy to have his mind set at ease that people weren't breaking into his house and changing his message. You know, this happened so much that he was convinced that there were kids who didn't like him in his school, or kids that he had maybe punished for something in his school, that would go into his house and change his answering machine message. And I figured it was probably because they were so cruel that, you know, he thought, these kids definitely want to get back at me. Who would just randomly want to change my answering machine to something so awful without, like, harboring some sort of grudge against me? And because of that, Dennis got an alarm system and also got a dog, which I think was a Doberman Pinscher, to make sure nobody was breaking into his house. I felt really bad. That's when it sort of hit me that this person who was faceless and I had a complete stranger, that I had tormented him. And while these things we thought were very funny, and maybe funny because they were so mean, were actually, like, horribly distressing to another human being. After we discussed how, like, the logistics of breaking into his answering machine, we sort of got into school and math and computers and skateboarding, and we talked about movies and sci-fi, and I remember talking for a while, and it became, after a while, just, you know, two people talking in a friendly manner, because I think he felt like, you know, I wasn't just a terrible kid. I was just a kid on the wrong path. So we were able to, you know, meet on a level of just being friendly. He's the kind of person that you would want to be as a teacher, I think. You know, I think he taught for the right reasons, because he, you know, loved kids and he wanted to help kids. And so this was the sort of thing that, you know, maybe immediately he knew he was going to forgive me. And he dropped the charges against me, which I believe were harassment charges. About 3 years after all of this, as a senior, I was hanging out with these kids, and they decided they wanted to make fake deposits into ATM machines. They would say that they were depositing checks into their account. And it was back then, I think, the ATMs would give you, like, a percentage of the check you were depositing, and they would steal the money, which is a crime that you're definitely going to get caught for. But I remember they were going to do that one night, and I just bought a Smiths record. And I was like, no, I'm going to go home and do English homework and listen to this Smiths record. And so that was a definite thing where I was like, no, I'm going to be good, and I'm going to go to college. So when I was applying for colleges and didn't have a lot of money, so I needed as much financial support as I could get. I had my English teachers at school, but I also was thinking, you know, one other teacher who could show my improvement in life would really be helpful. So I contacted Dennis, and he was happy to, as a teacher, I think. He was sort of like, this could be helpful for this kid. Experiences like this certainly made me learn that you could be creative and funny without being cruel. That was a big lesson that I learned, maybe even later in life, or that just not being cruel at all, even when you're not trying to be funny, is usually the best kind of thing. My mother never really learned that cutting out negative aspects of your life would usually cause you to have a more positive life. And that's something that I sort of figured out on my own, and certainly probably colored by this experience, for certain.
Derek Erdman is a writer and visual artist who called Seattle home before recently moving to Chicago. His story was produced by Jennifer Wick. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, this is Sound Effect, and our theme today is imperfect crime. We're about to hear the story of a criminal enterprise that was not just imperfect, but incomprehensible. That's according to Ben Blum. He wrote a whole book about the crime and one of the perpetrators. The book is not a whodunit so much as a whydunit. It's called Ranger Games, a story of soldiers, family, and an inexplicable crime. Blum explains how the robbery unfolded.
So on August 7th, 2006, at 5:13 p.m., a group of four men wearing ski masks, body armor, sweatshirts, and carrying a mix of assault rifles, AK-47s, and pistols, burst into a Bank of America branch in Tacoma, Washington. Within seconds, one of them had vaulted clear over the bandit barrier, the large plexiglass shield protecting the tellers from the rest of the lobby, and the others had seized control of the interior space. Within 90 seconds, one of them had been taken back to the vault. The one behind the bandit barrier ransacked all the cash that the tellers had in their drawers, and they were out of there before the police could arrive.
How much did they make off with from the bank?
They made off with about $53,000.
And who was driving the car?
The car was driven by Alex Blum, a 19-year-old private in the U.S. Army Rangers stationed at nearby Fort Lewis, who happened to be my younger cousin.
And who were the robbers? They sound like they must have been very experienced bank bandits.
They were very experienced tacticians, but they were not bank bandits up until that day. Two of them were fellow Army Rangers posted with Alex at Fort Lewis, one of them a superior of his who'd been his first team leader. And two of them were Canadian associates of that superior, Specialist Luke Elliott Summer.
How did they get caught?
By the absolutely stupidest avenue possible. Alex's license plate was uncovered, and a witness in the alley behind the bank saw him drive up and jotted it down. It was traced to his father's house a couple days later. Alex was there on his final leave before deployment, and a SWAT team descended on him.
Wow. When you first heard about this crime and discovered that your cousin had been involved, what were the first things that you thought about this?
I was absolutely stunned when I received the call from my father saying that Alex had been arrested. Alex loved two things growing up, hockey and the Army. He had been a almost cartoonishly well-behaved kid, into the Army, dedicated to his goal, deeply patriotic and idealistic. So the predominant feeling was just bafflement. And then along with the rest of the family, I started asking why.
And did you get answers to that question early on?
We started to get answers. They trickled in. Alex was in federal detention and unreachable for the first couple of weeks. Finally, his father, Norm, got in to see him. That was when we learned that a superior had organized it. And we learned shortly after that that it was actually fairly common practice among Rangers to go out to facilities around Tacoma in their off hours and war game them. Bad ideas around of how you would take the place down as a chance to exercise their tactical skills. So according to Alex, the bank robbery plans had seemed to him just another one of these games. There was some suggestion that he had even, after the crime itself, managed somehow to keep believing that this was all some sort of training exercise and that a higher-up from the Rangers was going to appear any minute to clear up the confusion and spirit him out of prison. It was only 8 months into his imprisonment that he began coming to a different perspective on his involvement in the crime. And then it was after his release, after 16 months, that I started talking to him in detail about how he had believed this crazy thing.
So how did he explain how he became suggestible in that way, how he became open to the idea that, you know, this whole thing was kind of a put on or an exercise?
He was a young and naive private who had just come out of the so-called Ranger indoctrination program. Alex wrote a detailed account of what he experienced there, and it was incredibly brutal. At one point, Alex and his comrades in the program had to hold a telephone pole up for 48 hours straight in a team of six, taking brief naps one at a time beneath it as their only break. The sleep deprivation is ongoing, so there's a whole folklore that's passed on between the cohorts that go through this program of ways to make it through that Alex learned from the previous guys. They would squeeze Tabasco sauce drops into their eyes. They would cut little slits in their earlobes, into which sometimes they would pack like chewing tobacco. But I think It's the cumulative effect of day after day of punishment, degradation, and sleep deprivation that ends up exerting a really transformative influence on the psyche. So he had just come out of that. He was 4 months into his assignment to the Rangers, and he was looking to his superiors there to mentor him and provide him the skills he needed to survive in Iraq. He couldn't wrap his mind around the idea that this superior that he took to be a upstanding and particularly helpful and caring Ranger could actually be a criminal.
Yeah. We're talking, of course, about Summer, who was the obviously the ringleader of the robbery. So how did Alex explain his actions in terms of what he had gone through and the mindset that he had assumed after that brutal, brutal regimen of training?
Well, the word in the beginning was brainwashing. He, after 8 or 9 months in prison, read a book given to him by his father about the brainwashing techniques that various cults use in their own initiation processes and just saw parallel after parallel with what he had gone through. It was at that point that he finally let go of his delusional dream of getting back to the Ranger Regiment, having this whole thing somehow magically cleared up so he could carry on deployment.
How did you come to think about Alex's explanation? How credible did it ultimately seem to you?
Ultimately, the intuition that I'd had almost from the start that there was something implausible here began to seem to me the most important voice to listen to in my head. It just wasn't ever possible for me to gain imaginative access to those few minutes when he was getting into a car with guys in the back wearing body armor and sweatshirts and driving them to the bank and sitting there as they jumped out. How is it possible not to understand at that point that this was a real bank robbery? And then I started talking to Summer, and Summer claimed that Alex had been a knowing, willing, even enthusiastic criminal accomplice from the start, who had always been aware that this was a real bank robbery. So that was the real crack for me, and I could no longer accept this family story that the Blums had been clinging to, and I started to challenge it in some very direct and confrontational ways. That's the book ends up with a very direct confrontation between me and Alex over the truth.
Yeah. Is that something you want to save for readers?
Yeah, I'd rather not give the resolution of that confrontation, yeah, other than to say that it was kind of surprising and transformational.
So do you think this could have happened to anybody? Could this have happened to you?
That's a good question. No, I don't think this could have happened to me. I did not share Alex's military ideals. I think, Summer, when he was explaining to me how he managed to manipulate everyone into going along with his scheme, said that the one language that speaks to everyone is the language of their own personal desires. He was able to call on the best impulses of everyone involved, like hearken to their personal values, to their sense of themselves as heroic in some fashion or another, and bend those to his own ends. And I think it would have been very hard to bend my own ideal of being like a historic mathematician to the end of robbing a bank. Maybe he could have bent me to cybercrime in some way or another.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it certainly has been eye-opening for me to see how radically and in such a short time someone like Alex can come to the point of doing something previously unfathomable.
Ben Blum wrote Ranger Games, A Story of Soldiers, Family, and an Inexplicable Crime, and he joined us from the studios of WNYC in New York. Thanks so much, Ben.
Thanks for having me.
This is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. Today, the theme is imperfect crime. For people who are in prison, the question of how did I get here has at least two answers. There's the crime, or at least the conviction, But often the source of the problem goes way deeper. About 10 years ago, a Seattle police officer stepped into a prison and asked a simple question. If something could have changed your path, what would it have been? The answers would shed new light onto the stories of incarcerated people. Sound effect producer Jennifer Wing has the story.
About 10 years ago, Seattle police officer Kim Baguki was doing gang prevention work. A lot of these kids' moms were in prison. So Kim went to the women's correctional facility in Purdy, Washington, to ask them personally if it would be okay if she worked with their kids. The moms were reluctant to say yes.
Probably the last time that those mothers saw police, we were taking them away from their children. And then what I found interesting is I said, you know, would your children, would your daughters look at us as a resource? Would they ask us for help? The mom hats went on and they started talking about how they had told their kids to lie to us, to be afraid of us, to not answer the door, to try to pull the wool over our eyes, for lack of a better word. And then what happened, and I don't even know what started it, but they started sharing their stories with me. And I had this epiphany, like, oh my gosh, like, obviously something hadn't worked for them. Of course, I wanted to keep the dialogue going, so that's when I randomly asked the if question. You know, if there was something somebody could have said or done to change the path that led you here, what would it have been? And it got really quiet, and I just kind of let it go.
One inmate, Renata Abramson, filed that question away in her mind.
And all on her own, she started asking the women to answer that question. So she was able to get these women to write the answers down. So when I went back in, she came up and asked me, do you remember asking that question? And I'm like, I don't know, Renata, I was pretty nervous. And she said that if question. I was like, oh yeah, I kind of vaguely remember it. And she said it back to me and she said, here's answers to that question. And she handed them to me and kind of feel like time paused for a second. Something happened. And when I looked down, what I realized is, first of all, they were not just on regular paper. Some of them were on napkins. And the individualized story written in pen and pencil and their own font and their own whorls and dotted I's and cross T's and their signature, which we don't see much on the outside anymore because everything's computerized. So not only was it that emotion on paper, but it felt so much more personal and individualized that it kind of blew me away.
This was the start of the IF Project. Today, the IF Project runs writing workshops in prisons. It mostly focuses on women, and inmates have written more than 3,000 letters to themselves. The number one response to the if question is wishing they had a more positive role model when they were young. And Kim says that by acknowledging this void, sometimes for the first time in their lives, the women take a deeper look at what life was like before prison.
No one to listen to them, no one to care for them, no one to be there. One of the saddest ones I got was my mom not dying. It was like one sentence, she wrote it down and it was done, but she kept coming back and going deeper into what that ended up causing. So in our writing workshops, we've had a lot of women start somewhere and go as deep as they possibly could.
My name is Melissa McKee. I am 39 years old, and I have previously been incarcerated at Washington Correction Center for Women, and I spent a total of 11 years in there.
Melissa has been out of prison for a couple of months now. She's building a new life in Olympia. Over the past decade, Melissa has written hundreds of responses to the if question.
I think one of the first times that I answered it, I wished somebody had told me that it wasn't too late, because I derailed young. I had dropped out of school. I had gotten pregnant. I had, you know, ended up in a relationship that was not satisfying on any level. And I thought that I had already blown my chance. And so answering that question the first time, I wish somebody would have told me that it hadn't been too late.
Using the answers to the if question as kind of a guide, Kim Baguki and her team look for ways to support people when they get released. Since the number one response to the question is that someone didn't have a good role model when they were a kid, then maybe a mentor could help them when they get out of prison. Again, Melissa served 11 years. When she was released in June, the IF Project found her a mentor, Ren Emerson. Ren is a sergeant at the jail in Olympia.
People do deserve a second chance, and there are going to be people that are going to be successful. We don't always often see that, but I think we need to look at that and not be so negative.
Ren helped me to regain my humanity. There is a lot of isolation inside, and the way that you're treated in there is as a lesser being. That is a real thing. And when I came out, I felt like I wore that everywhere I went.
Melissa remembers one specific time when she felt like she was still in prison, even though she was out, doing a work release program, grooming dogs.
I was at work and one of my clients had called, and I was still in the work release facility, and one of the girls that I worked with answered the phone, and the person on the other end of the line specifically asked for me by name, and the look on her face as she looked at my employer and said, "But she's not supposed to get phone calls here." It made me feel so other. And it really touched me deeply inside in a painful way. And that day, Ren had stopped by and brought lunch. And I went out and I sat in the car with her, and I said, "I felt like an alien." And she said, "You're not an alien." And she just was patient with me and exercised kindness in a way that I, you know, needed so desperately. It's really easy to feel like you don't belong. And so to be pulled in has been essential for me.
Ren helped Melissa find an affordable apartment. She taught her how to use a smartphone. And she took Melissa into the woods so she could sit under a tree for the first time in over a decade. Melissa just started taking classes at the Evergreen State College. One of the last responses Melissa wrote to the if question before she was released from prison was this: "What if society made room for me?"
That story from Sound Effects, Jennifer Wing. This is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today our theme is imperfect crime. Well, the ultimate crime, of course, is murder, and that is a crime in which it's impossible for a victim to get justice. And that was what was on Tony Bamonte's mind as he was working to solve those crimes as the former sheriff of Pendere County.
Murder cases, they're important cases. You take somebody's life away and all their friends and all their relatives and how it destroys everybody. And the police, we're the voice of the dead. You know, we're there to defend them and stick up for them and try to find out who killed them. That's who we are. They have nobody else speaking for them.
Tony retired in 1990, but while he was sheriff, he went and got a master's degree. And for his thesis, he dug into all these old unsolved murder cases. One that caught his eye happened all the way back in 1935. The victim was another lawman, George Conniff, the marshal in a place called Newport, northeast of Spokane. A reporter in Spokane wrote an article about what Tony was doing and about George Conniff's unsolved murder. And then another Spokane reporter named Bill Moreland would pick up the thread on the suspicion that the man who killed George Conniff was also a police officer.
And one of the people reading that piece that day was the son of the slain marshal. He said, "My sisters and I would like to learn more information." And they're astounded to learn for the first time, and they're in the twilight of their lives, that a police officer may have been involved in the death of their father. And it was a secret that had been withheld from these people for all their lives. And you could see from their raw emotions that they were just obsessed with this, and they were, of course, eager to know more. So I urged them to reach out to Sheriff Bamonte, which they did.
You can see the sadness in their eyes, just the way it was heartbreaking for me to see what they were going through.
When George Conniff was murdered, it was 1935. The country was mired deep in the Great Depression, and shortages of basic staples created a thriving black market for things like dairy products. Yes, this was a murder over stolen butter.
Some burglars were burglarizing a creamery in Newport. So the sheriff is on patrol one night.
George Conniff happened upon the scene and confronted the burglars.
A gunfight apparently occurs.
Conniff emptied his pistol, didn't hit anybody, and was shot, I think, 3 or 4 times.
And the sheriff ends up dead.
The robbers got away, but signs pointed toward a main suspect in the shooting, a troubled Spokane police officer named Clyde Ralston. So half a century later, reporter Bill Moreland started poking around.
I found a series of stories where Ralston's name had been mentioned. He subsequently was involved in fatally shooting a 15-year-old kid who had stolen a car and was running from police officers. And a short time later, Ralston left the employment of the police department. It looks like he left under pressure. And in my contact with the Spokane Police Department, they refused to admit that they'd ever had a police officer named Clyde Ralston. Even when I dug out archived newspaper articles showing that, yes, Clyde Ralston had been an officer, that he had been involved in other episodes that generated news coverage, and they refused to acknowledge they even had somebody by that name. And it's like, how deep does a code of silence here go?
Another police officer enters this story, Dan Mangan. He's 86 years old. He worked for the Spokane Police Department. His daughter reached out to Tony Bamonte because she knew her dad had something to do with the murder of George Conniff.
He'd go to the police guild and he'd get drunk a lot. And then when he'd come home, he would tell her, you know, I need to talk to a detective one of these days. And she would say, well, why is that, Dad? Well, I can't tell you. And then when this story broke,
she said, told us both separately that my dad, working the beat with Clyde Ralston, knew all about it, knew that Ralston was involved in the murder. And in fact, Dan Mangan even knew where the murder weapon had been disposed of in the Spokane River. And he told me the whole story. It was in a paper sack, and we all knew why we were getting rid of it and whose gun it was and why we were getting rid of it. It was involved in the murder of a town marshal.
I said, did you drop it or throw it? He says, I dropped it. I said, where was it dropped from?
And so I drove down to the Post Street Bridge. I showed up there with a photographer. And when you're standing on the bridge with a 86-year-old retired police officer, and he says, yeah, I knew that my fellow officers were involved in the murder of another police officer, it's like jaw-dropping.
Dan Mangan, the retired Spokane cop who was in his last years, wanted to get this off his conscience. He said higher-ups in the police department told him to get rid of the murder weapon.
Law enforcement in 1935 was involved in covering this up, and law enforcement in 1989 were still involved in covering it up. The next thing was I got a call. Tomorrow at daybreak, Vista Power Company will be lowering the river level so we can go down in the riverbed where Dan Mangan told us he dropped the murder weapon.
And the river's going to be without water in most of the area for probably about 4 or 5 hours, and you'll be able to go down there and search then.
And Sheriff Bamonte and some of his metal detector volunteers plan to take advantage of that and search the river bottom to say, you know, is it possible the gun's still there? I mean, I had no way of knowing. I really didn't think they would find anything.
It was extremely slick down there. It was just like walking in mud. As we started the search, I explained to everyone it was dropped from here.
I was, again, on the very bridge that I'd stood with Dan Mangan, and I was looking at below and could see the sheriff and some of his people scouring the riverbed.
And when I found it, it was so rusted and old, and it was almost disintegrated.
The words of Dan Mangan were echoing in my head. It's like, there it is, right where he told me it would be.
The handle grips were completely rotted off it. The hammer was rotted off it. The trigger guard was rotted off it. When I carried it up and the Connors saw it, all three of them were in tears about this. And it's so small and little to realize that this was the weapon that was used to kill their dad.
There's the gun, and it had been there for 54 years.
So they found that murder weapon after half a century, which seems like a one in a million shot. But how likely is it that they could also find the suspect after so long? Well, Bill Moreland, the reporter, tracked down Clyde Ralston, the man suspected of taking part in the deadly butter burglary. He was now a little old man living in a small town in Montana, and Moreland went to confront him.
My strategy was to just show up unannounced. I knocked on his door. His wife answered. Of course, I identified myself, told her who I was and where I was from, and let her know that this case was so important that I had driven this far to talk to Clyde Ralston in person and let him know I really was interested in his side of the story or what he had to say about this. And she sort of stalls me, hoping that I'll, you know, sort of go away, I guess. And I just kept her talking. I said, I'm just interested in who is Clyde Ralston. I mean, he's been painted to be this killer of another cop. We know that he left the employment of the police department after shooting a teenage boy fatally. Tell me more about him. There must be more to the man. He's your husband. Tell me about him. So she brings out a wedding picture of the two of them and starts opening up slightly. And then I said, well, I appreciate the opportunity. Is there any chance at all I could shake his hand? And in the background, I hear Clyde Ralston say, I'll shake his hand. And he comes hobbling out the door. He let me take his picture. And it's a picture of, you know, clearly an old man. He's standing there in his white stocking feet with his gnarled wood cane, his pants held up by suspenders. He has on a long-sleeved print shirt. He's got his glasses tucked into his pocket. He looks old and tired. It's the final days of Clyde Ralston standing on his porch in St. Ignatius, Montana, denying that he was involved in a 1935 murder of a police officer.
This case stretched on for over a year. It became the oldest active murder case in the United States. And even though the flaws in this perfect crime were now exposed for all to see, Ralston was never charged with the murder. He wound up dying in his hometown in Montana, a free man. That's it for the show today. Sound Effect is produced by Kevin Kniestedt, Jennifer Wing, and Posey Gruner. We had help this week from Shane Mailing and Derek Erdman. We get multimedia help from Parker Miles Blom. Aaron Hennessy is our executive producer. You can keep up with Sound Effect by subscribing to our podcast. And if you already do, please rate and review us. It really makes a difference in helping us reach new people. Send your feedback to soundeffect@knkx.org and find us on Facebook. Come on back next week when our theme is Money Well Spent. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is KNKX.